I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. There's no doubting the systemic abuse this country has inflicted on Aboriginal communities. Indian residential schools are part of our shared history, but it's still a history unfamiliar to many. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is partway through a 5-year mandate to document that history and to set the stage for healing and repairing the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal communities. Bob Watts has been a key player in that process. Watts was interim executive director of the commission and a member of the team that negotiated the historic Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement. He is a former CEO of the Assembly of First Nations, serving as the chief of staff for former National Chief Phil Fontaine. And Bob Watts is the 2012 Vancouver Human Rights Lecturer. His lecture was recorded on November 1st at the First Nations House of Learning at the University of British Columbia. Here is an edited presentation of Bob Watts' lecture, titled Rights in a History of Wrongs. What does a just future look like for Indigenous peoples?
Bonjour, Sago. Kanoshinwak, Indigenous, Mukwedodam. My name is Tallpine, but you can call me Bob, if Kanoshinwak is kind of tough for you. When I was first approached to be this year's human rights lecturer, I was pretty overwhelmed and have given a lot of thought in terms of things to say that would have meaning, would resonate with Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people. We're in a pretty significant time in terms of not just the history of this country, but the history of this world. Some of our Indigenous traditions, we're talking about this time of great change that's coming. It's part of my heritage, Anishinaabeg people, Ojibwe people, talking about this eighth fire that we've moved into, and all the opportunities that are coming our way. And this wonderful banquet that the Creator has laid out for all of us to consider. It's not something that we have to do. It's something that we're invited to do. And part of that banquet is enjoying each other, understanding each other in a different way, trying to come to grips with our mutual and joint history here in Canada, to break down some of the barriers. We're neighbors with each other, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, and generally we don't know each other very well. We haven't treated each other particularly well. And we have opportunities, this banquet that's been laid out before us. And we have a lot of helpers that are there to help us think through this, to help guide us to that table. We have this wonderful institution called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that's guided by a number of really wonderful elders from across the country. In this past January, at a meeting in Ottawa, Governor General Johnson said, "We have deep roots together of shared promise and partnership." He said this was reflected in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which sought to achieve balance by allowing Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people to coexist and work together in the land we now call Canada. The Royal Proclamation predated Confederation by more than 100 years and is a foundation of our modern relationship. The Governor General said the basic premise of the Royal Proclamation was mutual respect. The Royal Proclamation was also about rights. It was also about land rights. It was about the rights of Indigenous people to govern themselves, to represent themselves with the Crown, to represent their lands and their peoples. So the Royal Proclamation is kind of like our Magna Carta in a way, in terms of setting this great foundation for us to do work together. And it's significant that at a meeting of the Federal Crown and First Nations, that the Royal Proclamation would be in play and would be something that would be significant in terms of that gathering. It helps us think about human rights. It helps us think about particular types of rights, both collective rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada and individual rights, and how they work with other rights in Canada. It is this really firm foundation that we can work from. Now, how we get from this idea of mutual respect to something like a policy of kill the Indian within the child is something that's pretty hard to comprehend. How did we do that as a nation? How did we go from this idea of partnership and coexistence and working together and fighting together in 1812 to less than 100 years later, having people talk about putting policies in place, putting institutions in place to kill the Indian and the child? What happened in our journey? Some of this history that we have is a bit of a whitewash, I would say, of things that are really important in terms of our mutual roots. John Ralston Saul, in his book, A Fair Country, said, "We are a people of Aboriginal inspiration, organized around a concept of peace, fairness, and good government. That is what lies at the heart of our story, at the heart of the Canadian mythology, whether Francophone or Anglophone. We are a people of Aboriginal inspiration." And Saul goes on through his book to talk about numerous examples, right from the justice system to notions of egalitarianism to other doctrines that find themselves in our Canadian institutions. And he finds Indigenous roots, Aboriginal roots, for a lot of those thoughts, for a lot of those institutions, for a lot of ways that we look at each other and have evolved together as a country. He couldn't find where some of those institutions that we're really proud of now in Canada is sort of saying, well, let's look back to Britain and we must have found it there. No, you didn't. You can't look back to France and find it there. It wasn't there. It was here. It was part of the Indigenous experience that was shared with newcomers and became Canadian institutions, and some that we cherish. So somehow this mythology, this discourse that we have each other, this dialogue about who we are, has got off track. It's been a rewriting of history in some ways that may have helped some feel better about perhaps stealing land or money, and this was in particular to Canada. I found the following quote in a U.S. high school history book that was published in 1987. In the book, it said, "For thousands of centuries in which humankind were evolving, forming communities, and building the beginnings of national civilizations in Africa, Asia, and Europe, America stood empty of mankind and its works. Europeans in the New World is the story of the creation of a civilization where none existed." So this is what a lot of our children are being taught. Not just in the United States, but similar things are found in history books in Canada. I had breakfast with a gentleman this morning, an Indo-Canadian, and he was reflecting on history books when he was a youth and growing up, understanding that Indian people were savages, uncivilized. And it really feeds sort of a doctrine of discovery. It helps put in place the rationale for taking lands. It helps put in place a rationale in the United States for things like manifest destiny, to be able to think that, first of all, to argue whether or not the Indigenous people of the Americas were human beings, and then to agree that the Indigenous people were human beings, but then to say, but they're not civilized, and they don't cultivate their land, so it's okay to take their land. So this is a mythology that gets written up in far too many books. This is a reason why we have things like land claims and land disputes, because it is a fabricated history. So contrast what was said in that U.S. history books with the notes of explorer Verrazano, who wrote in 1524. He wrote of the Indigenous people in what's now the area of Rhode Island. He said, "Here we find people confident, beautiful, and taller than we are. They had polished stone, sheets of worked copper, seagoing boats, and had tilled fields which stretched inland for 80 to 100 miles. Or Cartier, who wrote in 1535, he wrote of the warm greeting he and his men received, being showered with fish and cornbread. We're pretty famous for cornbread. and remarked on the well-tilled and beautiful open fields near a town called Hochelaga. It's significant that as indigenous lands were taken over, at the same time, people were writing the story of saying that this was a wilderness, that the indigenous people were nomadic, that they didn't have an agricultural base, that they didn't have a civilization, they didn't have cities. When now we find out we had cities, sometimes 70,000, 80,000 people in the Americas, sometimes larger. Some of the largest cities in the world at the time were in the Americas. But we've been told this story about our history, which has done us all a disservice. I teach a course at Queen's University in reconciliation. What I find is talking about residential schools is a nice sort of framing for being able to talk about reconciliation and why we're in this era of reconciliation. So some of them have heard about residential schools. Some of them may have heard about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But we end up talking about opening up this dark chapter of Canada's history. I always have at least one residential school survivor come in and speak to the class. Invariably, most of the class ends up in tears. So they go on this journey from heartbreak, from hearing about the tragedy of residential schools, lives ruined, families ruined, communities ruined. Most of the pathologies that we think about in terms of Aboriginal communities, you can draw a straight line back to residential school. So they go through this journey of incredible sadness through to anger. Why did it take them till they're in their first or second year of a graduate program to find out about this piece of Canada's history? Why wasn't it taught in high school? Why didn't their parents tell them about it? Sometimes why didn't their church tell them about it? So we end up at this point in class oftentimes where students are mad at their parents, mad at their high school, mad at their church. But we can't leave people there because that's not what the journey talks about. The journey talks about reconciliation. How do we take those emotions and channel them into something that contributes to a better society, that helps to create understanding, that helps to heal wounds? It becomes a bit of a reconciliation journey right in our classroom. But it's instructive, I think, for all of us in terms of what we don't know about our own history. And it's not something that's just particular to non-Aboriginal people. For a lot of Aboriginal people, we haven't been taught this history either. In some ways, there was a conspiracy of silence about what happened in residential schools. A few brave souls broke that silence. Some were criticized for doing that, saying, like, don't open this up. And others saying, we're not going to heal unless we talk about this. Our families aren't going to heal unless we talk about this. And our relationship with each other, our relationship with the Creator, isn't going to heal unless we talk about this. Because a lot of people were hurt at many different levels. They were hurt physically. They were hurt emotionally. They were hurt spiritually. Oftentimes, people suffered great abuse at the hands of those that were representatives of God. How do you reconcile that? So when we talk about the need for healing, I know that some of us, we even think we maybe shouldn't have called it the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We should have probably called it the Truth and the Healing and the Reconciliation Commission. Because healing is this hugely important part of this journey that we're going on. And it's not just a journey for Aboriginal people, it's a journey for the whole country. Canada needs to heal in terms of its past. To me, this question that kind of haunts me in terms of looking at residential schools and looking even at some of the current policies, the way that Indigenous people in Canada, Aboriginal people, are being treated by government. And I can't help but wonder if there isn't just a little bit of bias somewhere that says, yes, Aboriginal people have human rights, but maybe they're just a little bit less human than the rest of the country. Maybe those rights are just a little bit less important than the rest of the country. Maybe Aboriginal people are a little bit less important. When you see things going on, like the way our schools are being funded, the inequality of schools on reserve, when you see child welfare services and the way those child welfare services are being treated, these are human rights complaints that are going on right now in Canada to try to have equitable funding for those institutions that play such an important role in terms of our children. Whenever we talk about some of these issues, it comes down to children, whether it's residential schools, whether it's the current schools in First Nation communities, whether it's the child welfare system, it comes back to children. Why is that? Why is it? Is it our Aboriginal children being targeted in terms of inadequate programming and inadequate services? I mean, we know at the same time that the Aboriginal population is the fastest growing population in Canada. And if there's any place where we should be paying real attention to, it's Aboriginal children. And we should be doing everything we can in our powers to make sure that those Aboriginal children succeed. The cost is far too high otherwise. But we're not.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. I'm Paul Kennedy. Bob Watts is the 2012 Vancouver Human Rights Lecturer, and his provocative talk looks at some of the historical human rights abuses endured by First Nations communities, in particular, the legacy of those abuses at Indian residential schools. Here again is Bob Watts.
So just to flip back a bit, we have a guy, Duncan Campbell Scott, who is the head of the Department of Indian Affairs for a long time. He worked for the federal government for 53 years. So that tells me something about him right off the bat. I lasted about five. So he went from a clerk to the superintendent of Indian Affairs. And a lot of the programs, a lot of the design, a lot of the policy work that were foundational to residential schools was under his authority. Residential schools didn't happen in a vacuum. It was part of a specific policy to kill the Indian within the child, part of a policy of aggressive assimilation characterized by themes such as the final solution and themes like, I want to get rid of the Indian problem. Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department. Those were the policy themes that underscored the relationship between Aboriginal people and Canada in the early 1900s. Those were the themes that you see manifest throughout the residential school era. And not everybody that worked in the residential schools were bad people, were evil people. You see all kinds of memos, people writing to Duncan Campbell Scott saying, we need more money, we need to be able to fix the windows, or we have inadequate food, or we don't have proper bedding for the children. We need more medicine because children are sick and dying. And most of that fell on deaf ears. When Duncan Campbell Scott was superintendent of Indian Affairs, he sent his daughter to a boarding school in Switzerland to be educated. And tragically, she died at that boarding school. Scott went into this really deep depression. He was inconsolable. What is amazing to me is that he didn't have the ability to look at the Aboriginal people in this country and recognize the same thing was going on in far too many families and communities across this country. Children were dying in huge numbers in residential schools, or sometimes being sent home sick and dying at home. sometimes dying at school and the family's not knowing about it for years. But it really does beg this question of whether or not, either from a personal reflection from Scott or from a policy position, whether or not Aboriginal people were viewed to be less human. That the feelings that he had as a parent, that somehow or another the many Aboriginal parents across this country weren't feeling the same thing. I don't know, but I think it really does beg that question in terms of how folks look at each other. Residential schools weren't the first experiment in education. There was industrial schools prior to that. Many of those schools, kids went home at the end of the day, and instructors complained that program wasn't working. What they said was the wigwam was stronger than the classroom. There would be all this great learning that would be done during the day, and kids would go home to their loving parents and siblings and aunties and uncles and grandparents perhaps, and all that good learning that had happened throughout the day was somehow or another undone. So given that the wigwam was stronger than the classroom, there needed to be a fix for that, and the fix was residential schools, to remove the children from their communities. This breakdown of the family unit started with that. There's a huge tragedy that these children were taken away, sometimes as young as 3 or 4 years old. Imagine having your reason for being, the center of your existence, being taken away. What does that do to you as a family, as a community? And hearing people say that, there was no laughter anymore. The children were gone. So there's a profound impact that happened in Indigenous communities right from coast to coast to coast. In the residential schools, there's broad occurrences of disease, hunger, overcrowding. In 1907, the Indian Affairs Chief Medical Officer, P.H. Bryce, reported a death toll amongst children ranging from 15% to 24%, and rising sometimes to 42% in Aboriginal homes when sick children were sent back home to die. So imagine that. Imagine any school in this country that had a death rate of 10% or of 20%. Imagine 1%. But it happened. And it happened in communities. Not all these residential schools were out in the middle of nowhere. Some of them were in towns. So it's not like folks didn't know that these residential schools existed. But there is this ongoing conspiracy of silence. For residential schools, the government partnered with a number of churches. The intention was pretty clear, was to educate, assimilate, and integrate Aboriginal people into Canadian society. The types of abuses that far too many children suffered caused things like post-traumatic stress syndrome. There's even a residential school syndrome. Made it difficult sometimes for survivors to go back to their own communities because they had been dislocated from their community, oftentimes for years and years. Didn't speak the same language anymore. Maybe didn't have the same religion anymore. The last federally administered school closed in 1996. And I think that's significant. A lot of times, we think of these issues and we think, oh, my goodness, that happened so long ago. Just get over it. 1996 was just a few years ago. When you consider the Indian Residential School Agreement, when it was signed, there were some 80,000 residential school survivors estimated to be alive at that time. So this is an ancient history that we're talking about. These are people that we see oftentimes, maybe every day, as we're going down the street. Part of the mission of residential schools was accomplished oftentimes just by distance and by time, with children being taken a long ways away from their parents for an extended period of time. The ability to transmit language, Indigenous knowledge, culture to children didn't happen. And sometimes it wasn't even distance. In some cases, there was residential schools right in an Aboriginal community, but it might as well have been hundreds of miles away because there was no access. That might have even been even harsher sort of torture. to have your children so close by and not having access to them. In May of 2006, the government announced the approval of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. There is tremendous pressure on government to figure out some sort of a negotiated settlement. And there was thousands of court cases in the queue. More and more class actions were lining up, and it was really clear that the court system was just going to be clogged up with these cases. National Chief Fontaine put together a proposal to look at a negotiated settlement. With the Assembly of First Nations, we entered the process with lawyers from class actions right across the country, some representing individual survivors, lawyers representing churches, government, other Aboriginal organizations. I remember one time we were in Calgary. We were having a break, and I was outside talking with one of the elders that was part of our team. And I said, "How do you think things are going in there?" And he said, "Did you ever watch that Nemo movie?" And I said, "Finding Nemo?" He says, "Do you remember the seagulls?" And I said, "Yeah, I remember the seagulls." He goes, "Yeah, it was mine, 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 mine all the time." And he says, "That's what's going on in there." He said, "Where are the residential school survivors? They need to be first and foremost in everybody's mind, or we're not going to have a successful negotiation." So we made sure the National Chief knew about that. And it actually, I think, changed the dynamic of the negotiations. The Assembly of First Nations, through Phil Fontaine, ended up launching its own class action and to ensure a seat at the table and being able to speak to every significant issue. So the residential school agreement went through the courts, had to go through all the major courts in Canada to be approved, and we ended up with the settlement agreement that covered things like the common experience payment. It put in a new process for survivors to file claims for physical and sexual abuse, put in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and it put in this limited program for the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. It's not a perfect agreement, but it was the best that we could do at the time. One of the things that we thought about long and hard, and survivors that we met with talked about, was the need to put something in place that first of all recognized the harms that were done at residential schools. So this was done through this thing called the Common Experience Payment, which said just the very act of going to residential schools, being denied the right of family, being denied the right of language, being denied the right of culture, being denied the right of association, all of those things, just the mere fact that you went to residential schools was something that was compensable. And that was a really difficult thing for government to understand. They argued that it wasn't a harm. It wasn't a harm that you could demonstrate. If someone had had their leg broke or their finger cut off or something, then that's a harm that you can readily observe. And there's a chart that says this is what the compensation for that harm should be. But having your spirit stolen, having your heart broken, having your family taken from you wasn't something that was considered a harm. But thanks to folks like Andy Scott, who was Minister of Indian Affairs at the time, and Paul Martin, we were able to get that into the agreement. So Canada was the first world country to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And sort of unique in the history of the world is that it's looking at the experience, the mass human rights violation of children being told by adults. It's unique in the world in that regard. We were fortunate in terms of designing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of having help from other TRCs, sister Truth and Reconciliation Commissions from around the world. One of the really important things that we learned from the International Center for Transitional Justice was that we needed to manifest the outcomes that we sought to achieve. So that became sort of the watchword for all of our work. When we did dialogues across the country and met with survivors about what they wanted to see from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that was our watchword. Significantly, in 2008, The Prime Minister stood before the country and offered an apology. And I want to read part of this apology because I think it's significant in terms of understanding history and understanding relationship. So he said, "I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in these schools is a sad chapter in our history. The government of Canada now recognizes that it was wrong to forcibly remove children from their homes, and we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that it was wrong to separate children from rich and vibrant cultures and traditions, and we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that in separating children from their families, we undermine the ability of many to adequately parent their own children and sow the seeds for generations to follow. And we apologize for having done this." He said, "The burden of this experience has been on your shoulders for far too long." He's speaking to the survivors. "The burden is properly ours as a government and as a country. There is no place in Canada for the attitudes that inspired the Indian residential school system to ever again prevail. You have been working on recovering from this experience for a long time. And in a very real sense, we are now joining you on this journey. The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly." That day was, a really significant day in Canada's history. It was an affirmation for so many people that what they had talked about and what they had experienced was real. It was in many ways a message to so many Aboriginal people that it wasn't your fault, which is really significant. So many of us will know that as children, sometimes bad things happen to us, and as children, we oftentimes blame ourselves. So we had so many Aboriginal people across this country carrying this hurt, this great shame with them, that there must have been something wrong with them for this tragedy to have befallen them. Institutional apologies are often really difficult to deliver and to be sincere about. And I know that in some of the places where I go and speak and in classes that I teach, people ask me that question of whether or not I thought the Prime Minister was sincere. And I absolutely think the Prime Minister was sincere. I think the question that we have for all of us is, what can we do to help manifest that apology? I think it would be a great tragedy if we ended up having to have a future Prime Minister apologize for nothing happening because of the apology that was given in 2008. Since 2008, we've seen huge cuts to Aboriginal programming, and having to take some important issues like child welfare to the Human Rights Commission. So we need to find ways of encouraging the government to manifest reconciliation. There's important people, significant people in Ottawa that have their hands on the levers of power and significant sums of money that could, through some small gestures, do things that would have incredible significance in Aboriginal communities. So they need to be encouraged to find ways of respecting the rights of Indigenous people. And that politicians would often say, you know, it's really hard to be able to focus on your issues, that they're just really not that important back home. Now, in some ways, I think that's a bit of a poor excuse, that we have a thing called the honor of the crown. And the courts have been really clear in terms of their expectation of the way the federal crown will operate and carry out its fiduciary duties. But maybe they do need encouragement. Maybe that's part of the role that all of us have in terms of reconciliation, is to find ways of encouraging and helping stand up those institutions, those legislatures, and the parliament, and encourage them to address Aboriginal issues, to address this unfinished work of nation building in a way that brings honor to the crown and brings honor to this country. We all have this opportunity to be part of trying to give expression to creating unity out of diversity. We all have this opportunity to carry out this work, some of the unfinished work of nation building. Michelle Jean talked about that many, many times when she was Governor General, talking about this unfinished work that we have as a country, this unfinished work of nation building.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 159, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. Bob Watts, the 2012 Vancouver Human Rights Lecturer, has been involved with major Indigenous issues in Canada for over two decades. He points to the critical work currently underway with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And he notes that despite the sincerity of the federal government apology to the survivors of Indian residential schools, the work of building trust between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal communities will require decades of healing.
Some writers have referred to the residential schools as a national crime. I tend to agree that it was a national crime, but I think it's a crime that's still alive and well. Whether it's the 60s scoop that we talk about as Aboriginal people, where so many Aboriginal children were taken from homes and adopted out in the United States and adopted out to families in Europe, basically because their parents were poor. So many of the child welfare issues, so many of the issues in our communities in terms of child welfare really comes down to an issue of poverty. And then we have this chronic underfunding of schools. I mean, it's right in the Auditor General's report. It's there for every one of us to see. We can see that if an Aboriginal child goes to school in a First Nation community, they get funded at about $4,500, maybe $4,700, $4,900 per student. If they go across the border and go to school in town, they'll get funded at $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000, depending on what jurisdiction that they live in. If you can put $9,000 per student over there, why not do it over here? And they say, well, because we have an agreement with the province to do that or with the municipalities to do that. So it's the same thing with child welfare. It's actually the basis for the human rights complaints that are going on right now, led by the Assembly of First Nations and the First Nation Caring Society. What the federal government is basically saying, it shouldn't be with the Human Rights Commission in the first place. Because in order to consider whether or not something is a violation of somebody's rights, you have to be able to compare it to somebody else. And so what the federal government is saying is that for these children that are within the child welfare system on reserve, they're being funded by the federal government. The federal government doesn't fund those children off reserve. Given that the federal government doesn't have a program over here, we can't compare the two. So if there's no comparator group, there can't be a human rights violation. Hopefully that gets blown up pretty soon in terms of an argument, because it's essential that even if there is no strictly a comparator group, that just this idea of sort of natural justice or natural equity would say that we should find ways of ensuring that Aboriginal children have the benefit of the same sort of schooling, the same sort of educational opportunities for child welfare as a child that's off reserve. What's the big difference? So the federal government spending millions of dollars defending this thing, had plenty of years, like years and years of negotiations to try to find a negotiated settlement. People didn't want to go and take this as a human rights issue, but they had no choice. This human rights issue of child welfare, right behind it will be a human rights issue of education, right behind it will be a human rights issue of policing, and on and on and on. Everything from clean water to not having moldy homes. And these will all be human rights issues that we need to sort through. That's going to cost millions of dollars to sort through these issues when we might be able to find a different way of doing things if we're really thinking about how do we make that apology manifest? How do we make it work in terms of policy, in terms of regulation, in terms of legislation? How do we breathe life into that? What's incredible is that we have many, many institutions, financial institutions and think tanks that are saying, you know, government, you really need to invest in Aboriginal children. The payoff is incredible. National Chief Atlio recently said, we can invest in our people to benefit all Canadians or continue paying the price to perpetuate poverty. Canada's economic fundamentals require greater economic participation of our quickly growing population. He said, it is worth repeating the research showing that closing the gap in terms of skills and education gap between First Nations and the rest of the population will generate $400 billion within a generation, and it will save Canada $150 billion in social costs. Who wouldn't take that bet? I don't know if somewhere within Ottawa, people are thinking that Duncan Campbell Scott's sort of dream that Indians will be absorbed into the body politic, that that's just going to happen like any day now. Maybe next week there will be no more Indian question and no more Indian department, so why invest? Because it's right there. Well, it's not. I mean, the Aboriginal population has sprung back in huge numbers, getting culturally stronger, getting politically stronger, getting legally stronger, and are deserving of the sort of investment that National Chief Atlio talked about. Our country deserves that sort of investment and that sort of payoff for our entire country. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has continued its work through all this time. They released a significant interim report. So they reached a number of important conclusions about the residential school system. It said residential schools constituted an assault on Aboriginal children, on Aboriginal families, on Aboriginal culture. Residential schools constituted an assault on self-government and self-sustaining Aboriginal nations. The impacts of the residential school system were immediate and have been ongoing since the earliest years of the schools. Canadians have been denied a full and proper education as to the nature of Aboriginal societies and the history of the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. They said it will take time and commitment to reverse this legacy. The schools operated in Canada for well over a century, and in that same way, the reconciliation process will span generations. It will take time to reestablish respect. They said effective reconciliation will see Aboriginal people regaining their sense of self-respect and the development of relations of mutual respect between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. The Commission recommended that the federal, provincial, and territorial governments and all parties to the settlement agreement undertake to meet and explore the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And they talked about this as a framework for working towards ongoing reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. So these sort of international instruments will force us as a country to reconsider the place of Indigenous people, Aboriginal people, and the country, and in particular the rights of Aboriginal people. Some of what the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People contain, it talks about that Indigenous peoples have the right to the full enjoyment as a collective or as individuals, and this is significant because most human rights documents and treaties in the UN system don't talk about collective rights. But when we talk about the Indigenous rights, they talk about it both collectively and individually. So they have both the collective and individual rights of all human rights, fundamental freedoms, as recognized in the Charter of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and international human rights law. It said that Indigenous peoples and individuals are free and equal to all other peoples and individuals and have the right to be free from any kind of discrimination in the exercise of their rights, in particular that based on their Indigenous origin or identity. It said Indigenous peoples have the right of self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. It talks about self-determination. It talks about distinctive legal, economic, social, cultural institutions. It talks about the right to determine their own identity and membership and structures and leadership selection in their institutions. So we have this significant UN document. And in the document, it talks about this idea of free, prior, and informed consent. And I think this is going to be one of the things that, as a country, we're going to struggle with. It says Indigenous peoples have the right to free, prior, and informed consent on the following: any action resulting in forced removal or relocation from their lands or territories, any change in existing or creation of new laws or regulations by governments that affect them, any projects affecting their lands and territories particularly with the development, utilization, or exploitation of mineral, water, or other resources. Free prior informed consent means that Indigenous people should determine whether a project can go ahead or reject or set conditions for project implementation based on their collective decision-making processes. So I think this is going to be a really one that we're really going to struggle with. More and more, we see mega projects happening in Canada that get identified as being sort of in the national good, in the national interest, and almost identifying some of those developments as the commons, that it's something that all of us own and all of us have a part of. And I see a time, we're not too distant future, where we're going to have this idea of the commons, the national good, is going to butt heads with free prior informed consent. We're going to have to be really smart, and we're going to have to be really caring in terms of figuring out ways of working through that. Chief Adleo talks about the fact that Indigenous people aren't opposed to development, but want development to recognize their rights to land, to culture. Many Indigenous people oftentimes don't talk about these sort of legal instruments, these UN declarations, or the Canadian Charter of Rights, or the Human Rights Commission. Most often, Indigenous people talk about rights in terms of that which either the Creator has given us or that Mother Earth bestows upon us. And it talks about this mutuality in terms of rights, the rights of Mother Earth to be able to exist and flourish, and our right to protect her. And I think this is one of the things that we're going to have to struggle with as well. You see other governments around the world, some have already looked at passing legislation that recognizes the rights of the earth. Bolivia recently passed a law which recognized the rights of Mother Earth. But there is this mutuality in terms of rights and responsibilities and duties between Indigenous people and the earth, and in particular, the rights and responsibilities of women. And I think this is going to be something that, as men, we're going to have to sort through, whether we're Aboriginal or not Aboriginal, is how do we get that voice to speak for Mother Earth in terms of what makes sense and what doesn't make sense in terms of development. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, they talk about it as being an aspirational document, that it's not legally justiciable right now. Although some countries have moved to adopt the UN Declaration through their own legislation. And I think it's significant that it's phrased as being something that's aspirational. I'm not so worried that it's not justiciable. It's not something that we can take to the courts. The courts will end up hearing about it, inevitably. But I'm not really sure whether or not the courts are a good place for us to be as Indigenous people, to be placing these significant rights. But I think it's important that it's aspirational, that we should all aspire to see the things that are in the UN Declaration manifest in Canada. I don't even think about it as just aspirational. I think about it as being inspirational. This is one of these really significant documents in terms of the place of Indigenous people in the world community, within their own nation states, but as brothers and sisters around the world. As I said, I see some real hurdles in terms of understanding. I see some real hurdles because we don't have something that we can call a common history that we can all refer to and say, yeah, that's our true history. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission will write part of that for us. But we need to have some understandings amongst each other in terms of our time together on this land and what that means in terms of the future. And I think we're lucky because I think Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, if there's one thing that most people in the whole world, I think, have in common, is that we all want a better future for our children. And that's a pretty good starting place. Governor General McAlejean, she talked about, when the present does not recognize the wrongs of the past, the future takes its revenge. For that reason, we must never, never turn away from the opportunity of confronting history together, the opportunity to right a historical wrong. This is what Truth and Reconciliation is about. It's some kind of refoundation, some unfinished nation building in this country. She said, we have been given the opportunity to be reborn after an overwhelming chapter in our history and to imagine how we want to live together. So this is up to us to figure out these things. There's no template to say this is how it's done, that these things have to be worked out between people. That's the opportunity. That's the banquet that's laid out before us. That's our opportunity to create unity out of diversity. Murray Sinclair, the chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he said, to those of you who would say, that's in the past, why don't you just get over it? He counters, we and you are not out of that past yet. Our families were broken apart and must be rebuilt. Our relationships have been damaged and must be restored. Our spirits have been stolen and must be returned. Our love for life was turned into fear, and we must work together to learn to trust once again. Paul Chartrand, who was with the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, he said, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions are like spring ice. They need lots of support. You know, sometimes in the spring, sometimes in the fall too, you go out and maybe it's a mud puddle or you got a little pond and there's that really thin ice. Just try to grab it, it's going to all crumple in your hands. And what he says that Truth and Reconciliation Commissions are like that. They actually take a lot of hands. And if we all work together and all put our hands together, we can lift up that ice and it's not going to crumble. And that ice will act like a prism. It'll manifest all these beautiful colors to all of us. But he said if any one of us tries to grab that ice for ourselves, it'll crumble on all of us. So that's really, I think, the task is to figure out how can we put our hands together to lift up this TRC, to ensure survivors also understand that we're with them on this journey of truth and of healing and of reconciliation. I remember I was speaking at Guelph University a couple of years ago. Somebody challenged me saying that reconciliation will never happen. And so I told him about my one of my really good friends was in his 60s. And it was the first time that he told his daughter that he loved her because he didn't know that was part of the deal. He wasn't told that when he was growing up. And that's reconciliation. And I think there's probably thousands of those little reconciliations that are going on all the time. And that all these many, many little tiny reconciliations, maybe like so many snowflakes, can gather together and become something really significant. So I encourage you, pay attention to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, to support it, to honor it, and to look for those opportunities that are given to us, that banquet table that's been set for us to sit around and to share with each other. In that spirit of reconciliation, in that spirit of nation building, and in that spirit of creating unity out of diversity. Thank you very much. Miigwech.
On Ideas, the 2012 Vancouver Human Rights Lecture with Bob Watts. This lecture was recorded on November 1st and was sponsored by the Laurier Institution, UBC Continuing Studies, CBC Radio 1, and the First Nations House of Learning. The Vancouver production crew was Yvonne Gall and Bruce Dierick. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and be sure to find us on Facebook. The executive producer of Ideas is Pam Bertrand, and I am Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now for the hourly news on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite Radio 159.